Welcome to the App and Admin Podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin working at a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And we are back again, and it's, am I right in saying it's 54? I hope I'm right in saying we're on 54.
We all think it's episode 54, yeah.
I've run out of,
hopefully everyone else will.
Yeah, I've run out of fingers, counted them. So if it is 54, then it's that's the number for Xenon. So I know we haven't mentioned Xenon before, so we mustn't have got this much. What I call Argentina, that's what you need to do. 54 cards in a deck of cards. There is one. There's 54 countries in Africa. Binary is 110110. And it's the number 36 as a hexadecimal. So it's been a couple of weeks since we were last on. So what have you two been up to since then?
Yeah, well, I think it's been more than a couple of weeks, I think, since we last published. I think.
Possibly.
Yeah.
With people going on holiday and their birthdays and me working away for like 2.5 weeks or something in Italy. We finally got our podcast out and hopefully get this one out quite soon again. I was doing my job where I was we were talking about last time about how we split up a subnet. It all went successfully well, which is good. But I'll go into a bit more of that in a bit afterwards. But so we didn't really get to speak to Jerry. Didn't get to speak to what he got to last time. So what have you been up to, then, Jerry? It's been a long time.
Well, yeah, it's been quite a long time now. And I think when I last told the listener what I was up to, I just started this new job in Camden, doing Kubernetes and all that good stuff. I've just been carrying on with that. I think I mentioned I was working on the Logstash thing last time. We kind of discovered that it never got beyond being tested, hadn't been properly deployed into any environments yet. So I went to have another look at it. The container was still running, and I did change some configurations, redeployed the containers. Remember, we were talking about immutable infrastructure last time. So you make a new container, put it up, the new one didn't work. So we've been looking into that, why that's not working. We think it's Elasticsearch because if you remember from two podcasts ago, I explained about Logstash where it gets data in, processes data, filters the data, and then outputs it to different destinations, main one being Elasticsearch. And what it looks like is Elasticsearch is getting too much data being shoved its way, and it can't deal with it. So we need to change the configuration of that. Then again, that means redeploying servers with the new configuration. So all fun and games. But yeah, interesting stuff. What else have I been doing?
So that Logstash thing was there's different components for Logstash, isn't there? Like different bits for it.
Logstash itself is the main sort of processing bit, but you can feed into that with different things. One of them being FileBeat, which is something. It's a little program that just scrapes the logs as they get generated on a host and then forwards it to somewhere, mainly Logstash. So it's a good way of getting your log data to from one host to another, basically. Then Logstash outputs to Elasticsearch. So that's those three main bits of software, I suppose.
Cool.
The other thing I was doing is building more traditional VMs, but using immutable infrastructure sort of methodology. So what you do there is you make a disk image, and you make it exactly the way you want it, with exactly all the configured in exactly the right way. And the sort of standard tool for doing this is called Packer. So what Packer does is, from HashiCorp, who also bought us Vagrant, among other things. And it works a bit like that. So you sort of give a base disk image, write a load of instructions in Packer about what to do to that image. So you could do things like add a provisioner, and for that, obviously, I would use Ansible because that's what I'm familiar with. And then you have another bit called Test Kitchen. Test Kitchen is actually from Chef originally, but it's sort of a language which allows you to write tests for your finished images. So say you're building a web server, you do all the Ansible stuff to get the web server up, installed, up and running, and then you want to test that port 80 is open, which would signify the web server's serving, doing what it's supposed to do. You can write that in pretty much plain English. So you just say port 80 should be open, or that sort of thing. Check this service is running, check this file exists, things like that. So you can tell if your config management code is doing the right thing. So that's basically Test Kitchen. And then to deploy all that, we're using Terraform, which is a language it's a DSL for cloud providers. So if you think of something like Puppet code is probably a good example. Puppet code is configuration management code. Terraform code is similar, but it's cloud provider management instead of configuration management, I suppose.
Is that written in JSON or something?
It talks to the AWS API in our case, which is in JSON. I think it's kind of a nicer wrapper around JSON, because if you've ever tried to write JSON, it's not easy. So
no, I've only ever heard of it, people talking about it. So
yeah, I think we did touch on this quite a few episodes back about YAML and JSON and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think you can do it with Azure as well. When you create a VM, you can basically just say, you can basically create Azure templates, and you basically just do it by kind of doing JSON templates.
Yeah. Terraform is kind of like, you say, I want an instance, and I want this kind of instance with, T2 micro or whatever, this much disk space, these volumes attached, type of hypervisor and all that, all these different parameters that you can put in. And it's just a kind of programming language in that way. And you can link things together and, loop over things and that sort of thing. So, it's quite powerful, interesting stuff. So that's mainly what I've been doing in my day job. In the interest of not waffling, though, I'll let someone else have a go.
So, Andy, what have you been up to?
I've got a couple of things to bring here. Now, one was a bit quirky, so you just have to bear with it. And I'm also going to put you on the spot a little bit. So you probably tell by now I like sort of putting you on the spot. Or both of you, really. okay, first off, there's something I listen to on one of the podcasts that I listen to, which is not computer-related at all. But something came up which was to do with a computer. Now, believe this or not, I mean, you probably won't believe it. And if you want to go and listen to it the most open mind possible. Cool. And just think of it as a interesting, crazy story. Okay. There's a podcast called Mysterious Universe. Don't know if any of you have ever heard of it. It's based in... The people that run it are in Australia. And generally it's all about, the UFO sightings, stories of that, ghost sightings, all that kind of stuff. And this one particular episode was about time travel and a BBC micro in the 1980s. Right? Now, I won't say any more than that, but we'll put a link in the show notes if you do want to go and listen to the episode. The story doesn't happen straight away when you listen to it. It's kind of like 5 minutes in or something like that. If anyone even has a chance to add this to their massive list of podcasts that they already listen to, you might end up being 51 hours behind instead of just 50.
I might have to schedule that in for next year or something.
Yeah. But when I listened to it, it was like, what the hell is this? Oh, my God. So it's a BBC Micro, 1980s, and time travel. Now, that's the only hints I'm going to give to you about it. So, but the next thing is, I was doing some tests somewhere in one of the dentist's offices I was at. I was using a program called Land Speed Light, which is the free one, probably. And I was just doing some network checks to see how fast the gigabit network was. And the program works really well. And it actually turned out that the network speed was perfectly fine. But one query that I've got about it, and I don't think this is a general thing or specific to the problem. Now, if we talk about broadband, right, fiber optic or whatever, your download speed is always faster than your upload speed, isn't it?
Generally speaking, yeah.
Yeah, generally speaking. But is that the case in a local LAN scenario?
I don't think so.
The only reason it's like that is because it's the way from the distance from an exchange. You can have it so it's equal, so that you could have it so that it's you could reduce it so that it's so you have a higher upload speed and a lower download speed.
Okay.
Because it's just the way how far it's away from the exchange.
But if we're talking locally on a local LAN,
yeah,
a local switch, it's because it was doing these speed tests between this computer that was furthest away from the main server. It was a gigabit network, and I was getting 800 megabits per second speed download or upload, whichever way you want to look at it. And then going the other way was kind of like 500 or 400 or something like that. And I thought, well, why is one fast and one slower?
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I didn't know if that was a particular problem there or whether, because I sort of thought that locally, take the internet out of it, but locally, the upload and download connection speed should be the same on a local gigabit LAN, shouldn't it? I would have thought, anyway.
Depends what it's writing to as well, though, if it's thinking, because like if you're pulling, if it's depending what you're pulling the server from as well, because if you're pulling something, sometimes a lot, if it's fast storage, it's reading quickly, and if obviously if you're reading something, it says it's downloading.
Yeah.
And if you're writing, it's got to write it to disk. It's got to acknowledge it's writing it to disk. It could be slower.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually. Yeah, because you haven't taken into account the disk speeds, have you, with that?
No.
Because that's what it does. You know, you pick a folder on the destination drive, and then it writes data to it and then reads it back again. So it's right, okay. So that's not really a true LAN speed tester, is it, really? You'd need something like one of those flukes for that, I would guess.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that kind of answers that question. Secondly, I've put two other links into the show notes of two things I found on the internet which were quite interesting, quite amazing, actually. One of them was setting up email, using email in 1984. It's kind of like a Tomorrow's World show. It's an English show. I don't know what show it was, actually.
Yeah, it might have been Tomorrow's World or something.
It could have been, yeah. And one of them was paying your bills online. And that was about 1984 as well. We'll put those in the show notes. And they said they did these tests, And I have to say, one of the people in one of the videos looked remarkably like one of the people on Numberphile. I don't know his name.
I'm just watching it now.
Yeah. The one doing the emails.
Yeah.
And he just looked like a younger version of the guy on Numberphile.
Is it going with white hair? And
That's right, yeah.
Just got all the really old computers.
That's right, yeah. Because he seemed to be into exactly the same sort of thing. And I thought, I wonder if that's him when he was younger. So I've got a couple of links in the show notes for people to look at, because I saw them and I found them quite interesting. Because at that point in time, I knew nothing about any of that whatsoever. You know, I just had my old Amstrad at the time. So the idea of an internet and sending emails to people just didn't come up, but this must have been on the likes of Tomorrow's World. I think it was called something different, though, to be honest.
I'll just have a look at that. It's a database on 10TV. So not all people, not everyone might have seen this.
Because maybe if it, no, in those sorts of times, you had regional TV, didn't you?
Yeah.
And it might not go national.
Yeah.
So it may have just been in the London area, that particular show.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's those couple of things for everyone to go and look at. They also posted, I don't know if you've noticed on the Facebook page, but there's been a flurry of activity on our Facebook page lately. And I think it all started, I posted a picture, and then somebody else has posted a picture of a similar thing. But I posted a picture of somewhere that I went to where the patch panel and switch has completely disappeared. We don't suspect that someone's nicked it. We know that somebody's nicked it, because you don't lose a patch panel and switch and rack. Even one of those cabinets, you know, the big cabinets that they go into, you know, a standard width rack kind of thing, all disappeared. And they've just cut the cables or pulled the cables back and left them in a hole in the wall. We've now got to figure out which cable goes to each socket in each particular room.
Sounds like a laugh.
So people will have to look on our Facebook page. It's a good opportunity to go and like the fake book page. It's not fake. It's a Facebook page.
Friend face.
And have a look at the pictures that have been posted. And also as well, if you came across that kind of mess, how would you go about it? I mean, the only way I've sort of thought about doing it is obviously the sockets at the other end are still intact. And I do have a little very basic network tester. Do you think it would be the quickest way of doing it would be just to, wire the cables into a socket, plug my tester in, and then just go around each one and figure out which one it is. And then wire that. That's the only way I can think about doing it. Is just getting the socket, wiring onto each cable that's left stuck in the wall, they're left hanging there, and then just wire it up and then go around and figure out which one it is. I'll be doing that next week. So.
You can get these things that kind of terminate. So you plug the network cable in. You'd have to put plugs on them all for a start.
And then...
So that makes them act as if they're plugged into a socket. And then, you'd have to go around and see to all the rooms.
Yeah.
And see where you get the light on the network device or whatever.
Yeah. That's the only way I can think about doing it, and then deal with that afterwards.
How did it disappear then? So isn't the place you went before where the electrician took it out or whatever then?
This is a place that I went to. This particular place I've never been to before now. They basically called me up to say that they're... I'm trying to remember exactly how it all went now, but it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago, like that, something like that. So they phoned me up to say that there was... they couldn't get any internet on any of the computers, right? And the people that normally look at the computers weren't answering the phone. So they were looking for somebody else to try and do it. So they phoned me up and said they had no internet on any of the computers. So I just thought it was a, you know, ISP problem or something. And then when I went down there, I was trying to figure out where everything was. And that's when we come across that. And they said, oh, there should be a box here, which was the actual cabinet itself. So I said, well, there's nothing there now. I should take a picture of the whole area because you'd see it better. So basically they'd figured out that, the only thing we'd figured out was the computer company that deals with them don't know why they weren't answering the phone. But we don't think it had anything to do with them. But they had some people in working like the end of the week before. So this was on a Monday morning or something like that.
Yeah.
And they were doing, they said they were doing some kind of alarms or some kind of wiring. And that must have been on the Friday, and then on the Monday they had no internet. Mm-hmm. And then they found out that, where's this thing gone? So I haven't got into it any further than that, because once I said that was missing and that was missing, they're then trying to find out who these people were. And I think they've got in touch with the police and all this kind of stuff. I haven't actually found out what's going on with that, apart from, you know, the whole thing's disappeared. In fact, if I go back there, I should take a picture of the whole area. Then you'll be able to see it all. But it's really crazy. I thought, no wonder they've got no internet. They've got no... nothing. And by the sound of it, there would have been, I don't know what was there beforehand, but I'm guessing a big, maybe a 24 port switch, would it? Or bigger than that. How wide's that? How wide's a normal rack, do you think? Is there a standard size for a rack?
19 inches,
right. So that rack there, I mean, I can see sort of where the value is, because the box is worth a lot, isn't it? Yeah, the box is worth a lot in the first place.
All right, so they took the rack as well then? The rack? Is there a rack there?
Yeah. Yeah, there's no box. No, they've normally got a glass door on them. That's not the, you know. I'm guessing the patch panel, you know. So.
Is that one of those ones that's mounted up on the wall? And
yes, it should have been mounted up on the wall, yeah, sort of like head height kind of thing.
So like a patch panel and a switch sort of thing.
So I'm guessing there was a patch panel in it, because they pulled the wires out the back.
Yeah.
Must have pulled it out the back of the patch panel, because, you know, there's still a bit of, when you look at the wires, the Cat5 cables comes out, there's still a bit of, you know, there's an inch or so or inch or two of the yellow and, the yellow and white and the orange and the blue and the green.
And that's exactly how they're wired into a patch panel, yeah.
Which are probably, you know, where they're pushed in with the termination tool. So all you have to do at the back is pull them, don't you? You know, if you pull them all out, unplug it from the mains, you know, pull the Cat5 cables out the front, you know, then it's disconnected.
Mm.
And then you unbolt it from the wall, then... it all goes out as one big unit, doesn't it?
Yeah, makes sense.
So, but I don't know what was there before. But now we've got the task of, apparently the people who normally do the computers are trying to get them to come down and sort something out as well. But because they've asked me to do something already, I'm going back to help out as well.
So basically, all the computers were saying, like, there's no internet connection or whatever, no network connection then on the
computers. Yeah, basically, yeah. Yeah, it was a bit like, because basically, they all had the wires pulled out the back, hadn't they, really? It would have said no, if they were Windows 7, they just had that red cross on it. That's all it would be. But of course, all they knew is the internet didn't work. That's all they were thinking. So that's another thing. So I'll update you on that. And one final question. to catch up on. Right. Is there a way to... Actually, I might leave this till another time. It's to do with Ubuntu. Is there a way to slim down Ubuntu so it uses a bit less resources and that kind of stuff? And also, is there a way to... I don't know if I'm using the right terminology here, but to repair Ubuntu. Now, like with Windows, there's several repair facilities that re-registers DIL files and things like that, permissions and all that kind of stuff. So might come back to that on another one.
Yeah, so, something to think about. Yeah, maybe listeners have, some listeners might have ideas. Who knows?
Yeah.
You
want the lighter version of Ubuntu, try Subuntu, which is the one with like an X at the front of it. It's got the XFCE interface on the front of it. If you're looking, are you looking for a desktop?
Yeah.
Kind of a...
Well,
it's a laptop. I'll show you the message I get all the time. People can't see this. This is the problem with it. But we're basically getting a message saying system program problem detected. And there's a little like do not enter sign on the top.
Uh-huh.
Right. So this is good radio again, because no one can see what this is. Mm-hmm. And I get this error message all the time, and it won't update either. If you go to the app updates, you know, get app update, all that kind of stuff.
In some ways, the best thing to do in that situation is get your home directory backed up and then just reinstall. I know it's a kind of you're not fixing it really. Just reprovisioning your system. It's quite easy to do with Linux.
Yeah, it is really. Yeah, I've actually got nothing saved on it. You know, so there's nothing really to save at all.
So look at Subuntu or Ubuntu or the. I'll put links and show notes. Which is basically like just two lighter versions. So you haven't got the whole. The Unity interface.
Yeah.
So I'm using.
There's Ubuntu Mate as well, isn't there?
Yeah.
The distro that shall not be named, as they call it.
Yeah, it took me ages to figure out what that meant. Because every time they said the thing that cannot be named, I'm thinking, well, what is it? Just name it. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. I'm using. Subuntu on my main PC, and I managed to fry one of my motherboards. My main PC died, and I've basically been using it on an old Core Duo, and it's been working absolutely fine. So I'm back on my i5 now, so it's good. It's just try those Ubuntu or Mate and see how it goes, really. So
okay, yeah, I might just reinstall with one of them or something like that. I only generally use it for internet, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Subuntu, but you've got XFCE, which basically feels like a bit like XP, Windows XP kind of thing. So
Ubuntu.
Yes.
Okay.
Have you done much with KDE at all, Gary?
I used to use KDE when I first started using Linux on desktop. I always used KDE, and even to the extent I installed Ubuntu and decided I didn't like GNOME 2 at the time. Can't remember which one it was, like, 2008 or something like that. But didn't like GNOME 2, so that's why I never tried Mate. And I installed the KDE sort of spin of Ubuntu at that time, and then that wasn't that good. So that's kind of why I didn't really go to Ubuntu. I used Fedora, so... which had its own problems, but it had a good KDE desktop. So, but yeah, that would be version 3 or so. I haven't tried. Was it Plasma KDE or KDE Neon?
Is
it?
Neon. So that's what I'm saying. There's one of the people from Linux Voice Podcast did a beauty video of his setup. It's really cool kind of thing.
Yeah. So. I wouldn't mind trying it actually. I want to get rid of. Manjaro on this my desktop at home.
Yeah.
really, because it's just a bit too, you know, it just needs, it's a bit too much hard work at this point.
Yeah, so I mean, I've been running that Mate for a couple of weeks and on my laptop. It's okay. It seems all right. This flipping between the applications get really confusing. I just like having it put on the top on my top. So I might give that Neo KDE thing.
I mean, the problem is my main desktop is, or, you know, computer is a Mac. So I've got Mac OS on it. And it's not great, Mac OS. It's okay, but it's not. I would prefer Linux, but.
I think you just get used to what you're using, isn't it? Because people may not want Windows 10, but I like it. I use it day in, day out, and it just works fine. So
I would like to try the Linux integration stuff on Windows 10. That interests me.
Going back to that thing, what Jerry's saying, Andy's saying about that that LAN light stuff to track, test the. I was using that when I was on my project, actually, to test the LAN speed of the network, because I was like, wanted to test it, the LAN speed from like 10 from 1 gig to 10 gig to make sure that it was working. I was using that and a thing called IP perf, which is like a utility, which is the same sort of thing, but it's a command line. So that's quite cool. And because what we're doing on this, we're doing this work on the ship about migrating from 1 gig to 10 gig is that at one point the routing was all done through the firewall. Sorry, routing was all done through the switch. And then they put it up through the firewall. So we wanted to test what the speed difference was going through the, what was going, being routed at the switch level and routing at the firewall level, which means we're doing it through the firewalls because it was so that we could do like rules and stuff. Whereas like the switching on the switch was just literally just per, wasn't doing any filtering or ACLs on that. So you were saying about the file transfer speed through, how far were we getting for the gig then? So on a gigabit network then?
It's about 800 megabits.
Okay. Because it can get confusing because, like, isn't it? We're talking about where we get megabits and megabytes, isn't it?
Yeah. So. I may not have even said that right. well, is it eight? When we say 1 gig, that's 8 gigabits, isn't it?
Depends what you say, is it? Because, like, it's like you talk about a file, which is a gigabyte, isn't it? Because it's divided by 8. And then when you speak about network speed, it's done in the bits, isn't it? Kind of thing.
Yeah. So you divide it. There's also a gigabyte and there's a gigabyte. So 1 gigabyte is 1,000 million bits, and one is 2 to the power of whatever it is.
But do you know what a nibble is?
Isn't it because a bit is 8, a byte is 8 bits, and I guess a nibble, if a bit is a 0 or a 1, a nibble is A0 or A1.
As far as I know, a bit is half a byte.
No, a bit is an eighth of a byte. I think isn't it?
A nibble is half a byte.
Oh, half a bit, you mean?
No, a byte.
Oh, byte. Oh, okay, so four bits.
A nibble is 4 bits.
Okay.
I hope I'm right in that one. If you don't want a byte, you just have a nibble.
Yeah.
Just remember that. So as a result, it's a gigabit network, but you're getting 800. Hang on, let's get this 800 megabit per second on a gigabit network.
I mean, it's never a gigabit. You never move data to a gigabit.
No, but what we're saying is that if you got a gigabit, a little b, if you transfer a gig file, a 1 gigabyte file across a network, it would take 8 seconds to transfer.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
because there's eight, because it's the way it works. So you're only getting 125 megabytes per second if you've got a 1 gigabit network, if that makes sense.
Imagine if they advertised broadband in gigabytes.
Yeah.
Because even now they'd be saying, hey, you can get a 2 megabyte connection. People would say, no thanks. But I think that's why they do it. It's a bigger number, isn't it? So it sounds more impressive.
Well, I think it's to do with, because data transfers are always measured in bits.
Yeah.
And then data storage is always measured in bytes.
Yeah.
Correct. It confuses the layman and it confuses
us because we will get it right.
And we've always got to correct people.
Yeah.
And they don't want to get it wrong.
So
that's it.
I was going to talk about a couple of things. So this, what I was doing about is transferring from the 1 gig to 10 gig network in my VMware environment, so that there's obviously like a 1 gig card in it, and then there's a 10 gig card with two connections on it, so that you for failover and load balancing. And in VMware, what you do is that when a VM is connected to the 1 gig network, it's on one port group, and when you go to you can have multiple port groups, basically port groups like the VLANs, so that you can tell it what VLAN you want to be on. So if you had like VLAN 10 and VLAN 11 as port groups, you can connect either, if you had a NIC in a VMware, you can tell it, I want to be on this port group or that port group, and it will then put you in the right VLAN. So if you're going from 1 gig to 10 gig, you have to tell it that you want to connect it to the 10 gig network and not the 1 gig network. And I had 100 machines to do this on. So I wasn't going to sit there and right-click each of the VM in the software and say, unclick on this, to swap it over to the to the right port group. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So it's labor-saving. You did some kind of
script
shell thing or something.
Yeah. So with VMware, you can thing called Power CLI, which is basically a module in VMware, a module where you can plug it into PowerShell, and you can say, so you basically just load it a module, and then you basically say, you can run through a CSV file and say, I want this VM name connected to this port group. So it's really quick. So I managed to do it, so it does it really quickly. So that's quite cool. So and I was using a command, and also obviously I had to change the port group, but also had to change the IP address of the VM as well. So from Power CI, you can tell it to inject, run a command from inside the VM. So instead of having to connect to 100 VMs, you can tell it to, as part of this script, to run a script inside itself, if that makes sense.
Right.
So, yeah, because I was changing it from one VLAN, so one to one, from 1 gig to 10 gig, but also at the same time, we're changing the subnet mask and the default gateway. If you remember, I was talking about last time.
Yeah. This sounds similar to the way AWS works. When you bring something up for the first time, it runs a thing called user data. Which is a similar sort of thing. It's generally like a bash script or something to do various things when it first boots up.
Yeah.
So I've used that quite a bit recently.
Yeah. So you can use a command called netsh to change the IP. If it's Windows 2008 R2 or above, it can use that command, which is quite interesting. So I didn't have to sit there and change the IP address on 100 machines, which is quite good. And it all worked flawlessly. So that's quite cool. I did have to do a bit of work because I couldn't. I was trying to get it to do it the other way around. So trying to pull the IP address out from the server, but it was putting it in a really funny array because it wasn't. I couldn't manipulate the data correctly because netsh isn't a PowerShell command. When it pulled the information and presented it to PowerShell, it was pulling it in a really funny format, and there's no way I could work out how to do it. But that was when I started using regular expressions to kind of like clear spaces, like and then put commas in so that I could basically pull it into Excel to do it, if that makes sense.
It's getting the right data in the right place.
But if you're probably a programmer, you go, oh yeah, I know what you're doing, what that array, because I think array of data means like it's like, you know, it was like an array of data inside itself, so like it's an array inside an array, if that makes sense. But if you're probably a programmer, you probably went, oh yeah, I know how to do that, you just redone this command kind of thing, and that's the bit where I start to struggle.
I know the feeling because you know, I haven't got a programming background, so but I'm starting to, you know, understand all this.
Yeah, and that's why.
Go ahead. So 35, 40 is a weird time to start doing that, but
yeah,
quite enjoying it though.
Yeah, I love programming like that because you could just, it has saved me so much time, and I know that it'd be correct because it can only do what you tell it to do, kind of thing. So
yeah.
So the other thing as well about, I'll put the link in the show notes, is about the DHCP export. So I had to, we're going from one IP addressing range to another IP addressing for the DHCP scope, and they had about 30 reservations, and I basically wanted to export them. So there's NetSH, using the NetSH command again, you can export them all, and then you can import it using that same command. So that you can actually, if you wanted to, you can change. Well, I changed a couple of the way it said stuff, so you can re-import it. So you haven't got to sit there and go into DHCP and right-click and say, add the reservation, add the MAC address, add the name, add the IP address manually. You could just do it from a script. So
it's kind of nice that Windows is getting this now. It's like, they say it works in 2008 R2. That's probably where people decided they need to kind of automate this. This kind of thing,
yeah,
because you're just doing it on loads of machines,
yeah.
Whenever you do anything, so
It's a bit like the whole Azure stuff. I'm doing quite a bit of that at the moment, and I'm looking at PowerShell and that, and a lot of the things you can't do for the port, you have to do for PowerShell, which is quite cool.
I'd say take a look at Terraform as well, because it's got an Azure. It talks to Azure. It's not. It doesn't do as many things as it does with AWS, but you know, it can talk to the API, and could be interesting.
Yeah. So, did you hear about the problem they had at British Airways as well with over the bank holiday weekend?
I did hear. I didn't hear much detail about it, but I've heard it being talked about and so on.
Yeah, they like had like. Their computer system was down, so British Airways' computer system was down for like 3 days, so no one could travel around the world if you're flying with BA. Yeah. Everything had landed. So I'd love to know the root cause analysis for that. A lot of people saying it's that someone pulled the power, a contractor pulled the power to one of the... They've got two data centers in Heathrow, apparently. I think they got like... I'm sure it said like they had like 600... I'll put a link in the show notes to our favourite, the register... who don't like the people who I work for, and they always moaning about them. So they've got 500 cabinets and then six halls across two data centers. But I don't understand how they're probably an active platform. I don't know how taking down one data center, you'd think that the other data center would be able to run without that data center working.
But the redundancy that they must have,
you'd hope.
You know, because. I mean, we talk a lot, don't we, about backup plans and, you know,
disaster recovery. And
that's stuff. And you'd have thought, you know, what's the chances that all of them go down at the same time? It seems a bit crazy to me. But it is quite funny that if you remember that BA from the A-team didn't like flying. So maybe
he wasn't getting on the plane.
Yeah. And I've gone down. I can't even do his accent now.
I was wondering. I wonder if it's because apparently, I was from someone else, they reckon they've got like 600 systems what interact with each other. And obviously, I think they've outsourced quite a lot of their stuff to other people. And then it was causing, I think when they had to put it all up, no one knew how it kind of all hanged together because it was live. It, nothing was stopped working, kind of thing. So well, there must have been sort of some sort of data corruption if they literally pulled the power to the data center. If you know what I mean? Unplugged the wrong thing. But hopefully we hear some more information about that kind of thing. Lessons to be learned, kind of thing.
It reminds me of that bit in Airplane where they're coming to land and all the runway lights go out, and it's like, you know, it's the camp guy has basically pulled a plug out in the control tower. And it's turned out with the runway lights. And it's like, oops, and it plugs it back in. And all the lights come back on again.
Just unplugs it.
So it's ridiculous. Like, a cleaner, not the plug out for the data center.
But, you know, things have happened, you know.
What it probably comes down to is they haven't tested their disaster recovery adequately. So they assumed it would work and it would fail over or whatever, and it just hasn't.
I think we had some emails, haven't we? We had an email in since last time.
Yeah, we did.
We do, yes. I'll have to find it up. Hang on a minute.
It's on the show notes.
We've got our show notes. Okay, let's have a look here. If I can find the thing. I've lost the show notes.
I've gone. Shall I read it?
All right. Okay, go ahead. Yeah, I've lost it.
Okay. I haven't got a name on the first one. It's just listen to podcast 50. Reminded me that I meant to mention MicroLive on iPlayer. Some interviews with Alan Sugar and Clive Sinclair. Oh, Simon C. That's from. I've watched that. I've watched those. I can remember watching them when they first aired, which is pretty scary. But yeah, it's some interesting ones on there. I think there's like two or three on there at the moment, and they're on there all the time. They're just sort of like from the BBC archive sort of thing.
Yeah, that's my friend Simon C. That's why he just emailed me. That's why I put it on there. So
Okay. Next one's this is from Wayne. We got this only a couple of days ago as we're recording. Hi, Andy, Alan, Jerry. Thanks so much for the podcast. I listen regularly to your tales of tech support. It's great to hear what is happening in the real world of tech, and it seems from your stories that you all do different types of IT jobs. I've picked up lots of tips from you guys, especially loved your foray in Linux, Andy, and also the EDC episode. What was that? I can't remember what that stands for.
Everyday carry. It's like the thing where we say,
the tool episode. I've been predominantly a Linux user for the last few years, but I use Windows at work. I've converted all my home computers to Linux, except one which I use for Ableton Live, which I believe is some kind of audio doohickey. I've done some digital audio production on Linux, but it's much slower, at least for me, to get places with it. Excuse me. Mark and I run a podcast called the Binary Times Podcast, which has many Linux stories and tips that we want to share. If you guys would like to have a listen, that would be great. Keep up the good work. Regards, Wayne. Yeah, so that was
there are a couple of good ones you wrote in. And of course, we've had some interaction on the Facebook page, haven't we, as well?
Yeah. I think he emailed in as well quite early on that the person from New Zealand, wasn't it? I could have met up with him, couldn't I? When I went to New Zealand, I should have dropped him a line.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So we were contacted by the other Al. He's had some questions for me about Office 365 and retention. So I was sort of emailing, I'll talk about it on the show. So he was texting me. He said, if you get a chance, I need to pick your brain about Office 365 archiving options. If I need additional software or licenses, customers concerned mostly about an employee deletion. I need to create a default retention from 15 to 39 days, but anything else I can do or worth looking at. Was trying to recover a few deleted emails at the account today from the admin console. Do you know if it got a specific license to restore deleted emails, or if you have a legal, or you have to have a regulation hold. Fairly confused about the whole situation. Right, so let's just split this up into two different things. So, right, the 14-day thing you were talking about is the functionality in Office. So if you're in Office, in your Outlook, sorry, and you delete an email, and you go into deleted items, at least you can go in there and recover that. But if he if the user deletes it from Outlook, from the deleted items, the user thinks that it's gone completely. Or the way you get in, if you click on an email and click on Shift Delete, it will go. It won't even go into a recycle bin. It will just go directly. It get deleted, but it doesn't actually get deleted. That 14-day period, which you stated, is the way it kind of holds any item which is deleted for 14 days before it gets deleted permanently. So it's like a soft delete. So the user can't see it, but they can actually see it by actually going into a recovered item. So that's like if you go into Outlook or into the Outlook Web Access, you can go to recoverable items, deletions, and you can, it will list all the items in there what have been deleted in the last 14 days. What you can do, this is a bit pointless as well, if the user knows about this, you can purge that folder, and that will then, those items will get, you can click on an item, click on purge, so they can actually, they have to delete it three times. That's one, is obviously delete it, so it goes in deleted items, and obviously delete it from deleted items a second time, permanently delete it. That will then go into the recoverable items folder, and from there they can delete it, and it gets deleted permanently. So that 14 days you were saying about, in Office 365, you can extend that to 30 days by running a PowerShell command. I think you can do it on the F2 on each user. The other thing you can do is the next part, is which you actually need a license for. If you've got E3 plan, that's fine, or above, you get this option. But if you are like on a business plan, one of the cheaper versions, you have to buy the archiving option, which is £3 per user. And what that does is you can do two things. It gives you litigation hold and in place hold. Means that it basically the whole so that means that the whole feature this whole feature introduced in Exchange 2010 is to preserve data for e-discovery. E-discovery is a thing which you can which is very clever, is that you can search the administrator can search everyone's mailbox. So it could, like, if you're worried that people are sending emails out, like, of your sales or your sales secrets, or people sending credit cards out, you can set up alerts for that. Litigation hold uses a user property is a uses the litigation hold able properties of mailbox. When this is in place, provides granular hold capability based on the query parameters and able to place multiple holds. Litigation hold only allows you to place users on all items on hold. You can specify duration period to hold items where the mailbox is in place. The duration is calculated from the date the mailbox item received is created. If the duration is set, items are held indefinitely or until the hold is removed. So that basically means that it does everything. So that basically will keep a snapshot of that whole box. So it will track the emails coming in, going out. So it will show you all the emails sent, all the emails received. Even if the person deletes the emails, you will from this e-discovery, it's like a report you can run, which is like which courts and solicitors can use actually in trial. So it's like you can export it and you can use it in the court of law. So the other part is the in place hold. It's basically where you specify what you want to hold. So you can say, oh, anyone you want to do the keywords or by send or receiver, and what sort of emails are like the only outbox. So, but to enable that, you have to buy this extra license. It basically just takes a snapshot of the mailbox, so that if anyone does delete anything, you've got access to those emails. Interestingly, as I was saying, but what you can do, I don't really know if you've got, I'm guessing you need to do this to enable the license is basically called is single item recovery enabled, which is basically, I think this is what you do to enable a mailbox so that it can be in place hold. So what this does is when someone message isn't delivered into your inbox or you edit it or anything, it records all this information, and when it gets put into the deleted items, the user can recover it. If the user then deletes it, it gets put into a dumpster, and then when you can delete it from the dumpster, the user think they're hard deleted it, but they haven't. It's still there. But that will basically store it for however long you want to store it. But from there, you can then, I'll put the link in the show notes, where it will show you how you can actually go in to Office 365 and then recover that deleted items. But I don't know, I can't find out if you actually have that. I'll have that archiving license. So I hope that all makes sense. And any queries, just give us a call, get the email back in, or let me know. Yes, so that's good. I think we're just about there, aren't we? No,
I think so. Yeah,
not too far off yet. Yeah, I've covered quite a bit today, haven't we?
Yeah,
lots of stories, lots of people writing in and interacting, which has been great.
Yeah,
cool.
Keep,
okay,
keep writing in and interacting. It's good. It's fun. Gets conversation
that's right, yeah. Going. Yeah, there's especially now there's been few links on the show notes, and there's some things on the Facebook page that's been happening. That guy off that plane was called Johnny, if you remember. Off airplane.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And he plugged it in, he said, just kidding. So I guess we'll all unless you've got anything else, we'll see you everyone next time.
Yeah. Speak soon, guys and girls.
All right, bye now.
Bye.